on Thursday, December 14th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO is in this year's Willamette Week Give Guide. KBOO has inspired and supported communities for nearly 50 years. You were an important part of this work, and your gift to KBOO builds fiercely just, creative, and independent radio. Join your friends and neighbors in supporting KBOO in the Give Guide. It's easy and secure. Help us make our $18,000 goal before December 31st. Go to the giveguide.org website and find KBOO in the Creative Expression section. And as always, thank you for your support of KBOO.
Okay, that's the music that will bring us to the Dirtbag very shortly. I just wanted to let you know this is KBOO Portland, and Jim and Glenn are in there ready to bring you news of, what was it now? Soil tests, pH, and the new temperate orchard conservancy. All right, back to the theme song, KBOO Portland. It's 11 o'clock.
Yes, the effects of the air. Hey, Jim.
Hey, Glenn.
This is Glenn Andreessen here beside you now until 12 noon. This is the Dirtbag, a program dedicated to mostly edible gardening. We'll talk about other things today even that may or may not be related to that. As I've made mention, Jim is here in the co-pilot seat. But speaking of weather-related metaphors, I guess co-pilot, that's not a weather thing. It's an airplane thing. But airplanes are very much related to weather. And Jim happens to be a little under the weather.
Just a little bit. It's actually, this is my brother that survived.
Uh-oh, that means I need to...
Thanks, Tammy.
But the our biggest disappointment is that the phones are down here. So not only will we not be able to have any answers to our garden snuppers or garden questions, but we will not be able to have Frankie on with us to talk about the Home Orchard Society's Temperate Orchard Conservancy.
And just to be actually really clear about it, it actually isn't the Home Orchard Society's.
Oh, it's not.
No, it's a separate deal. And of course,
it's its own 501(c)(3), probably. That's
right. And the people that have done it are, of course, members of the Home Orchard Society, but it is not a Home Orchard Society project.
Huh. Well, see, I've already learned some things here.
Yeah. And we can talk about that, even though without Frankie. But
well, hopefully we can have Frankie on next month.
Yeah.
If Frankie will agree to that and disrupt her day again.
Right. Right. And the phones will be working next month, of course.
Of course.
Yeah. No doubt.
Right. So it's just going to be the Jim and Glenn show here today. But I do have a selection of music, of course.
Sure.
So.
Great. Well, there's actually... fun stuff to talk about.
That's right. And the weather.
And the weather.
You know, last year, we had already had one ice event by this day.
I personally experienced that, trying to pick up friends at the airport. The day, maybe the second one, it took us 6 hours to get what usually takes 45 minutes from our place to the airport.
Well, we've already bypassed one of those.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah. Things look okay weather-wise. I mean,
yes. Now, Jim and I have been corresponding earlier in the week, and I told him that I was just tired of the wind. But I hadn't had any freezing or damaging cold yet. My potato growth was nice and green. My new potato growth was nice and green and whatnot. And Jim said, yeah, it was down to 20 here.
Yep. Night before last, 20 degrees. Last night was 26. Frost in the shade never goes away. And it's interesting because if you go all the way down the east side of the valley, west side of the Cascades, it's cold. Silverton was close to the same temperature. It's the cold air, I think, just comes down off the mountains and settles in these areas where there's no wind. So when you have the wind, you actually get the stirred up air, and mm-hmm. temperatures are a little bit higher.
Which is why until two nights ago, Monday night it must have been, that the wind died down enough that we did get now killing frost. That my potatoes now are showing cold damage.
Well, it is December, you know.
Yeah, last year the first frost wasn't till December last year either.
Right.
Keep track of those things.
I think that certainly there is a difference. That's an amazing difference to me.
Well, that wind, that's it. You know, it's
uncomfortable, but it keeps the temperature.
That's what I said, bring back the rain.
Yeah. I was actually uncovering some firewood. It was covered with plastic. And along the edges was rainwater that had frozen into what looked like boards. I mean, it was like 2x8s, thick sheets of ice that were quite heavy. It was really interesting, actually.
Uh-huh. Well, what does this mean for the garden? We'll get to that hopefully today. So we've got other things to talk about, of course. Let me see what we are going to talk about here. Well, we've got our garden stumper at half past the hour, but I know the answer. Maybe Tammy's going to be our only one to take to see what the see if she can guess what the answer is. Of course, she has the run sheet there with the answer on it. Okay, she's blot that out there.
And we can always have people call next time to tell us. We can run it by them again, and then have a new garden stumper.
That's true. That's true. Okay. Well, our plant of the month is walnuts.
Yes.
And let's see, I thought we would also talk about some non-gardening, actually, tasks, but things to talk about, which would be soil tests and also dormant sprays. I guess that is one thing that one could do, not in this cold weather, but just talk about what dormant sprays are and what one can hope to accomplish with them. Mm-hmm. Having said that, I haven't sprayed a dormant spray in probably a dozen years now.
Right.
But I used to do it religiously, but now either the tree either makes it or it doesn't.
Yeah.
That's my philosophy now.
Yeah.
And let's see. We will talk with Jim about what's going on the farm. Mm-hmm. What you can do things in greenhouses and whatnot. And what else here? Oh, yes, the Dirtbag Dictionary. This might extend to a little bit longer discussion, and that is pH and liming. Mm. You know, oftentimes we get recommendations to lime your garden this time of year or use wood ash or whatever. So I thought maybe we could discuss that.
Sure.
And we'll have our music selections that are related to, as it turns out, walnuts this year or this month. Okay.
Well, I'll be curious to hear what that is.
Okay. Well, I didn't find any pieces on walnuts themselves.
But walls or nuts?
Neither. You'll have to stay tuned.
Okay.
You grow walnuts?
Yeah, we have them. We really don't make a big deal out of it. We grow some, we've grown black walnuts, for seedlings for people that want to plant a little woodlot. But English walnuts, they're difficult to propagate.
Is that right?
Yeah. We used to grow, we grow them from seed to some degree.
Yeah.
And seedlings are reasonably good. I mean, they produce pretty uniform nuts and do well here in our climate. But it's, Oregon had a very big walnut industry 40-some years ago, 50 years ago. And that has sadly pretty much disappeared.
What can you attribute that to?
Well, the biggest problem was in 72, when they had a really cold freeze in the Willamette Valley. And the variety Frankette, which was the primary variety, was frozen back. And at about the same time, California was doing a lot of walnut breeding, and their walnut industry took off and sort of surpassed Oregon. Oregon just didn't make a comeback after that freeze. So, there were attempts, but there were walnut drying facilities in the valley. It was a big deal.
Yeah. I remember some years ago, we had, what was it, Glenn Mills?
Glenn Mills, right.
Yeah, and who had, I guess we were talking more about filberts at that time, but...
Glenn stuck with it, and he grew walnuts for many, many years. And, you know, I mean, there are small walnut orchards still exist in Oregon, in small scale, but the big industry's gone like that it used to be.
Uh-huh. So most of the walnuts that we would find are from out of state.
Yeah, but you can make an effort. You can find them.
Sure.
And they're really good. In fact, most people consider that our locally grown walnuts have more flavor and just a better, they're just a nicer nut than the ones from California.
Well, there's still a lot of street trees, tree nuts, walnuts.
Yeah. Yeah, and I had actually dreamed about walnuts last night, which I have no idea why, but maybe it was anticipation for the show, but I love walnuts, and they're just like a gift when they fall on the ground near you, and you can go out and pick them up, and it's good when you get a fresh walnut out of the husk, you should dry it for a while.
Sure.
They're not so good when they're green, and just open them up then, but let them dry for a few weeks in a cool room, or even somewhat warm room is okay, too.
Yeah. Well, the biggest problem in my neighborhood would be the squirrels.
Yeah.
You know, nut falls, or it doesn't even fall. They get them
They catch it as it's coming down, right?
No, they get it before that.
But there's a way to prevent squirrels from getting in walnut trees, which I think is kind of a fun thing to do because I like pitting my human
intelligence. All right, let's hear it, Jim.
Okay.
But realize that... Okay, go ahead.
Okay, so flying squirrels are excepted from this, but if your walnut tree is not touching another tree that, or several trees, or a fence or something that squirrels can just jump real easily from that to the tree, put a piece of sheet metal around the trunk, 2 feet wide piece of sheet metal, and those little claws on those squirrels' feet, it's like music to my ears.
Yeah, of course, that is tough in the city because things are right up against other trees or then leapable from a house.
Yeah.
And it's a problem.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the problem.
Yeah. I understand. Well.
But one can grow walnuts. I'm assuming sun is better than...
They like sun. Probably the biggest disadvantage with walnuts is they're a big tree.
There's no significant dwarfing
ones. And so, you know, if you're going to plant one from new, if it's already an existing tree, it's already probably got its space and great, you know, to harvest the nuts and enjoy them. But if you're going to plant one, make sure you need about a good 30 feet of space for it.
Which is, you know, really a big ask for city dwellers.
Yep.
You know, and the street, what do they call it, sidewalk strip now, I don't even know if they're permitted for that now. Could you plant one legally on the parking strip?
I'm sorry.
You don't know that.
That kind of word doesn't cross my
mind. Yeah.
Parking strips, you know, yes, parking strips are great. I plant everything. No, I don't have a parking strip, so.
Yeah.
But
something to consider.
Yeah, for sure.
I mean, then you're worrying about, you know, well, 30 feet, that's a big tree on that space, so.
Yeah.
And then, so, you probably, if you have a woodlot someplace. And
yeah.
Are they always grafted? Well, you said you can grow them from the seedling.
Seedlings work.
But you said they do okay there. But is it better to get a grafted one? Or
if you can do it, yeah. I mean, any pretty much any commercial, any fruit or nut tree that is grown for those purposes, a grafted tree is going to give you a more consistent production size, nut quality, and all that.
And you know what kind of, you know what's going to be.
Right. But a seedling can do quite well, too.
Yeah, I pull them up in my garden that the squirrels have planted.
Yeah, right.
More chestnuts that I pull up, but I pulled up walnuts.
Yeah. Yeah, I think, walnuts are a great source of food. They make a lot of food. And I think they're a beautiful tree, too.
They have a peculiar smell. And I guess we should talk about, too, if you know about this, the it's hard to plant things, it's hard to grow things under walnuts because of the compound, the Giuglione or whatever,
right,
whatever that's
right.
How it's pronounced.
It's especially the case with black walnuts more than with English, but the English walnuts can have also that inhibiting effect on other things.
Right.
But the trees make so much shade that it's probably
not much
reason to do anything underneath it.
Yeah.
Except hang out on a hot day.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's walnuts.
Yeah.
And maybe just since we do have time here, what's the difference between a black walnut and an English walnut, as we'll call it?
Yeah. The black walnut's actually a native to the U.S., where English walnuts are from Europe.
Is it, to interrupt here, is the black walnut the only native walnut?
You know, I'm sure there's some listener that can't call in.
Okay, so you're free to say it now.
That's right. I believe it is.
Okay. Nothing that's been commercialized or anything like
right,
that.
Right. I can't think of any other particular walnut, but there may be. I'll check, and maybe next time I'll have that information. But the black walnut's a very stately, large tree,
yes,
and grown primarily for its timber. Beautiful wood, and the East Coast, people plant woodlots of black walnuts. The nuts, however, are typically very difficult to extract the meat from, especially from seedlings. There are a few cultivated varieties of black walnut that are easier to crack and get the meat out of, but the English walnut is a magnitude easier than a black walnut for growing it for the nut meats.
Okay. So when you grow for sale black walnuts, is that that's not necessarily for the nut, but for the wood?
For the wood, yeah. Most people plant them as a timber
yeah,
tree.
Right, okay. Well, that's what we got on walnuts then.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. No calls.
No calls. I know, it feels funny, doesn't it?
Well, let's see. Okay, well, let's get into our music here then. And all of these, not all of them, but most of them have to do with the shells.
Oh.
Yeah. Although the first one, which is pick up the pieces. Because it's harder to have the full nut, meat, piece.
Yeah.
So oftentimes you get pieces of it.
Right.
Pieces of the walnut.
Yeah. The English walnut is pretty easy to have a half.
Yes.
Black
but
walnut,
not always.
Yeah. Black walnuts, on the other hand, if you're lucky if you get an eighth.
Okay, well, this will be dedicated to that one.
Okay.
But this is not by AWB, the average white band. No, this is by Tony Monaco Trio, organ player. So pick up the pieces. Thank you. Yeah. That's what you call hitting a groove.
Picking up the pieces, huh?
Right. Walnuts, that's Tony Monaco. The Tony Monaco Trio. He's an organ player. I maybe mentioned that before.
Yeah.
All righty. Well, let's get into some gardening tasks. I brought my list here, even. And one of those is to, for the soil, is to lime if, what does it say here? Lime if pH test warrants.
Uh-huh.
So this is all related here. Soil test, pH, and liming. So let's just talk about that. First of all, let's talk about pH. Get that out of the way. And it's not critical that we know what it is or how it's measured, but only that certain plants do better at certain pHs. It stands for the potential of hydrogen. And when it's written, it's a small p and a capital H. Capital H being the symbol for hydrogen. And so I wrote this down so I could get it right here. The term pH symbolizes the hydrogen ion solution. For example, in any solution, what percentage contains hydrogen ions? The pH scale runs from 0 to 14, with 7 being neutral, meaning that the amount of ions or ammonia ions and hydroxide ions in the solution are in balance. That's at 7.
Mm-hmm.
So anything about that, they're out of balance.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what does that mean? Well, it only means that plants that, for example, take or do better in a lower pH are able to absorb the hydrogen and other nutrients better at that level. So blueberries is a perfect example of that. They like low pH, somewhere below 5 even. But think of it around 5. Vegetables, on the other hand, prefer, 6.2 to 6.5. So still in the acid range. I can't even think about anything that really requires or likes a real alkaline. I suppose desert plants and things like that, maybe.
Yeah, nothing that I can think of specifically wants that. Some can tolerate it, but
yes. And I should just say right here too that I don't necessarily pay too much attention to the pH of a particular soil, because by using judicious amounts of compost, it can kind of buffer the plant, and the plant will be able to absorb the nutrients that it needs if it has a lot of humic acid, mm-hmm. which is part of humus, which is compost,
right,
if you will. So I did print out a chart, which is kind of fun to look at here. Zero, a pH of 0, which is the most acidic, what would that be? Battery acid, hydrochloric acid.
Mm.
But right there at 1, this is going to shock you. Maybe, maybe not. Stomach acid. I mean, it's no wonder that we get ulcers. You know, I mean, that stuff there is just, you know, if you don't have the good lining of your stomach, it just starts corroding right through.
Right. Well, it has a lot of work to do down there, you know.
That's right. And, you know, so by having that, it can corrode, if you will, or digest your food. So it's no wonder. But right. At 2, lemon juice.
Hmm.
3, now once again, just we're talking about a pH of 3 here.
Right.
Cola, beer, vinegar. Mm-hmm. 4, tomatoes. This is when you eat the tomatoes, not growing the tomato plants.
Right.
But, you know, that's a high acid plant, fruit. So for canning purposes, you might say, well, you need a high acid, you know, or you add vinegar if it's not high acid. Right. Maybe you don't do a lot of canning.
That's right.
Okay. 4.5, fish die if water is this acidic.
Huh.
So what do we? So we learn about the acidification of the seawater, the waters. That's going to be a problem at some point if it keeps being acidified.
Mm-hmm.
5 is coffee. 5.5, normal rainwater.
Hmm.
Interesting there, isn't it? At 6, you know, this is pretty good growing pH for vegetables. Urine. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to say anything more about that, but keep it in mind when you got to go. 6.5, saliva. Our own saliva. 7, which is neutral, water, but also tears.
Well, it's interesting that rainwater would be 5.5, mm-hmm. but just water is 7. I wonder how that. Yep. I wonder what happens.
Well, it picks up things in the air, and you know it can be ions. You know, a lot of things are happening when lightning and is in the air, and
yeah, but when the water falls and then becomes just water and not rainwater.
I'm assuming that once it's on the ground too, it's before it acidifies or alkalizes. Is that a word? Must be.
I think so.
Yeah. But, you got it, though.
Yeah.
Okay. Continuing on the scale, 7.5, human blood. Hmm. Mm-hmm. 8, seawater.
Ooh. Seawater.
That's pretty high.
It is high.
Yeah. Alkaline. Hmm. 9, baking soda or antacids. 10, the Great Salt Lake, which I've never been to. Have you been there?
I've been near it.
Didn't float in it.
I didn't float in it.
Okay. Oh, we got a phone call. No, we don't. Okay. And let's see.
10.
So. 10, okay. Great Salt Lake. Right. 11, ammonia. Hmm. Yeah, that's pretty. 12, bicarbonate of soda. We call that baking soda, mm-hmm. but it's not exactly. I did a little research on this too, and most of the parts of the world would call bicarbonate of soda that, even though, and they'd use it in their baking. Mm-hmm. But so it's a little bit different formulation, but same thing. 13, oven cleaner. And the most basic or the highest pH, the most alkaline, is sodium hydroxide. So that has to do with these ions then that come from water. So how does that matter to our plants? Once again, just let me rephrase this here, that the plant at certain pHs will not be able to absorb nutrients that are in the plant or in the soil because those nutrients are not available because they're tied up through this soil chemistry. Mm-hmm. But if by adding compost, you can free some of those up anyway.
Right. And in our own experience, so there's certain plant like blueberries, tea is another one that likes to have a more acidic soil. And what we see for symptoms of a too high a pH for those plants is yellowing of leaves. And I'm not a soil chemist, but what I understand, that's iron is not being taken up because the plant needs the lower pH in order to bring the iron up, and the iron is what will improve the color of the foliage, give the green foliage.
And it could also be that just other nutrients aren't available, maybe even as basic as nitrogen, which can lead us to a soil test. Do you get soil tests done periodically? Or
very periodically.
I recommend once a lifetime.
Yeah. Well, we do it maybe 2 or 3 times, but we do a lot of spreading of compost and cover cropping, and when we do soil tests, they always come out good.
Yeah, sometimes they don't even test for nitrogen,
right,
because it's just
right.
a given that you're going to need nitrogen. It's water soluble, and plants use a lot of it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've talked about this before, that the most plentiful element is on in the air is nitrogen. We breathe, it's almost 80% nitrogen, so we're breathing nitrogen all the time. But and plants would take it up too. I mean, they'd breathe it in. They would absorb it through the leaves. Mm-hmm. They emit carbon dioxide, but that nitrogen that they do absorb is in a form that they can't use, so it needs to be in the soil where it can be in a form that the plant can use. So just elemental nitrogen, N2, it needs to be something else. Ammonia, NH4, nitrates, nitrites, those are all forms of nitrogen that plants can absorb.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's important to get that nitrogen into a form that the plant can use it. Then that brings up the question, well, how do you get it into the form that the plant can use it? Well, the easiest way, but it's off limits to organic gardeners, is to give, to add nitrogen in a form that the plants can already absorb, like urea, a form of ammonia. But that's not organic. It's been changed. It's been processed. Usually it is a petroleum product where that nitrogen comes from, or the urea. But we can add other forms of nitrogen that rely on the bacteria in the soil to convert it. That's why a healthy food web is so, a healthy soil food web is key. And you got to keep that going. And of course, that keeps going by adding compost, because that's food for these mm-hmm. bacteria that then make these nutrients available.
Mm-hmm. Right. And I think for people who are wondering, like we just mentioned a moment ago about some symptoms of various new deficiencies, and the one that when we I was thinking about citrus too, because a lot of people grow citrus in containers here in the Northwest,
right.
and that's another symptom. The yellowing of leaves on your citrus plant would be another symptom, probably, of not having a high enough pH in the soil. Low enough pH.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, the more they lie also like in acidic soil, and changing the pH is not so easy,
And not so quick.
And not so quick, right? The commercial, you can do it with sulfur,
mm-hmm.
and I've done that actually using the elemental sulfur, and it actually works pretty good.
You can just buy that at a garden store,
right?
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And it would be considered organic.
Yeah, I mean, using peat and other acidic materials in your potting soil, if you pot a citrus plant or a tea plant or a blueberry, you know, look for a potting soil that designed for that has it's for acid loving plants.
And there would be the same for fertilizing those plants.
That's
there
right.
are acid loving plant fertilizers.
That's right.
So it probably pays to pay a little extra for the specialized fertilizer.
Yeah, you'll
have, and potting soil.
You'll have just much happier plants, and your crops will be better, and everything about it.
So let us return now to liming, because that is one of the easiest and maybe best ways to raise your pH. And here, of course, we have preferences. Oftentimes in the mainstream nurseries, that's what I'm trying to say, you might have dolomite lime, which would have both calcium and magnesium. But we really already have enough magnesium, and you really want those two to remain as far apart as possible, as far as the numbers go. And so I strongly recommend that you go with calcitic lime, or sometimes called agricultural lime, ag lime. Mm-hmm. And maybe or maybe not, you could find that at one of the local nurseries. You might have to go to a farm store.
Did we talk about how to test for this before you do the lime?
Well, no, we didn't. We didn't talk about only about for the soil test.
Yeah, I mean, I think that would be important for before somebody throws it on there.
Yeah.
Should check their pH. We have an interesting situation at the nursery where we have, you know, the natural soil in the Willamette Valley. Probably if it hasn't been limed or touched for a while, it's probably going to have a pH somewhere around 5.2 to 5.5.
That's what I would guess.
Our water, however, is like 7.2. The water from our well.
Mm-hmm.
And so we've had to try to figure out how to deal with that, because there's two things going on, and we very rarely do liming on our soil because it doesn't because the water pH is so high, and we have to irrigate that the plants don't struggle with that.
Yeah, that's interesting, because what did my chart say here for rainwater? Was that 8?
Rainy Water was
5.5. Yeah. Well, which makes a little bit more sense because I'm sure you probably get more rainwater than irrigation water.
Right.
But the irrigation water apparently doesn't change the pH. The permanent or whatever you might call that.
Right. It doesn't change the pH of the soil, but it does right. It does create a different environment for the plants where we have to.
Which may be better for the plants.
For depending upon the plant, if it's a blueberry, it's not
right
because it wants that low pH.
Except then the soil is getting closer to where it wants to be naturally. So
yeah. But as you've talked about using, if you're growing your plants organically with lots of good organic materials, mm-hmm. you're probably not going to have a problem. There's some pretty simple soil test methods.
Right, and I'm glad to come back to that. In that we're not advocating to pay $40 for a full blown soil test when all you really want to find out is your pH.
Right.
So there are some options.
Yeah. I mean, I remember little strips that
yeah.
you can, you make a solution of the soil and then you test in by dipping these strips in or a strip and you get a color that tells you pH.
I do that for my honey house uh-huh. when for washing jars and whatnot. Since I don't have a dishwasher there, I have three sinks that wash, rinse, and sanitize. And so the sanitize has a bit of bleach in there. Mm-hmm. And you use those same pH strips to test the amount of bleach. And they're pretty particular on that they don't, of course, want it too weak, but they also don't want it too strong because that would maybe discourage you from using it, you know, right. dipping your hands in there or something like that.
Right.
Huh. So these, that's a pretty easy option. Others are you can buy little probes mm-hmm. to put into the soil, mm-hmm. or you can, the master gardeners still will do pH tests at their clinics. Mm-hmm. Well, I shouldn't say at their clinics, at some of their clinics, where you can take probably as many samples as you want, two or three, I suppose, from different parts of your garden, and then go to one of their clinics they have them at gardening events or at farmers markets or they're right. pretty far spread out.
And for listeners that might wonder about how do you do this, I'm having done some pH tests myself, I'm sure you have, what we do is we have a field or a particular or a garden plot, and you take a sample of soil from several different places in that garden plot and mix it well together and then add distilled water, which mm-hmm. is supposed to have a pH of 7, right?
It should,
I mean, according to your chart. and then that water, after it sits with that soil, that's what you test then, is the liquid to see what that pH is. Soaking, essentially you soak the soil in distilled water.
And then when you get your results, depending on what it says, oftentimes they'll have recommendations. If it's 5.5, add X amount of pounds per 100 square feet or 1,000 square feet or
right.
something like that.
Right.
And the Home Orchard Society's task, general garden maintenance task from the Pome News, the Home Orchard Society's newsletter here, it says, and I get questions quite a bit about using wood ashes.
Mm-hmm.
And it says, wood ashes on garden soils raise pH, supplies potassium and calcium, save and apply in the spring, but no more than 25 to 30 pounds of ash per 1,000 square feet.
Mm-hmm.
So if you want to extrapolate that and take it down to 100 square feet, maybe you have a raised bed that's 10 by 10, still a pretty good size raised bed, that would be 1/10 of the amount, so 2.5 to 3 pounds of ash. That's not very much.
That's not very much.
Well, when I had a commercial soil test done shortly after I moved in, which now has been more than 30 years, and so more than 25 years ago, certainly, it said don't add wood ash for 5 years. And I hadn't added any. So maybe somebody had done that before, or that there was plenty of potassium there. I should go back and check the soil test and see what it was, but
yeah, that'd be interesting.
There.
Sure.
Okay. Well, let's take our next musical break here on Shells, and we will come back and talk about a little bit about dormant sprays and then what's going on the farm.
Great.
How about that? Who do we have up next here is, Johnny Copeland. Everybody wants a piece of the, or everybody wants a piece of me. A piece of meat. Yeah. Johnny Copeland. Okay, everybody wants a piece of me. We've got lots to talk about here, and boy, this crew is on the ball here. We've already got, this was posted a half an hour ago on our Facebook page. This is the KBOO Facebook page. Pretty sure that the Dirtbag doesn't have one yet, or doesn't have one.
Right.
And so it was posted, and we already have somebody's already answered it even.
Right, we've never even mentioned it.
But it was on the Facebook page. So the question, if you haven't gone to the Facebook page, let's see. Jim says, apricots and figs are quite delicious when fully ripe, but ripe fruits are rarely available. Why is that?
And we got an answer.
Kate said they need to be picked green for shipping.
That's about exactly right. Totally correct, right. And they don't ripen off the tree.
There's the key.
Yep. So that's why I'll have to say, I'm so frustrated and disappointed when I go to try to buy an apricot, because an apricot, you know, is a wonderful fruit. It's delectable when it's fully ripe.
But they don't ripen off the tree. See, I just don't have that much experience.
Yep,
I'm thinking, it's kind of similar to a peach, which does.
Yep. No.
But
they,
no, it doesn't.
They don't. And so they pick them hard so they can ship them, and that's why.
Do they soften or they color?
They rot. I don't know. They don't do what they're supposed to do, which is to get ripe, you know, and be that wonderful, delectable fruit. And so children grow up. We all grow up here on the west side of the Cascades. We don't get to eat a real apricot unless we're just somehow fortunate to, you know, get one brought to us from the east side. And so one of my goals in my rest of my life is to try to create an apricot that will grow here, be happy here. The problem with the normal apricot varieties, they're too disease prone for our climate.
Oh, it's disease. It's not necessarily getting them pollinated.
No, because they bloom early. No, you can, you know, if you can get to a point of having a tree with flowers on it, they'll pollinate here.
And but isn't when are those flowers? Aren't they February?
No, well, it depends, but there are late enough ones. We have some new ones we actually are experimenting right now from the Crimea that bloom later. But the problem is disease.
And, oh, I see.
And so, but there are species, relatives of apricot, like Prunus mume, that do well here. And so what we're going to try to do this year is to do some crossing of the typical fruiting apricot and Prunus mume, and see if we can find a hybrid that would have an acceptably good fruit and do well in our climate.
Well, keep us posted on that one.
It could be years, but I'm going to keep it's and then figs, the same frustration. You know, you go to a nice grocery store and they'll have fresh figs from California, but they're just not ripe. I mean, if you compare them to a tree ripened Desert King, Desert King knock your socks off.
Yeah. I mean, they're only good for really, I would say, a day after they're picked.
Yeah.
I mean, after they sit, you know, they start flattening out.
Yep.
But they're so good.
So
another argument for growing your own.
Yep. That's right.
Okay. Well, let's quickly move through our next tasks here. Do you want to just mention briefly more about the Conservancy?
Yes. So I think probably most people have not heard of this organization called the Temperate Orchard Conservancy. It was started by some members of the Home Orchard Society who saw a collection of apple trees down in southern Oregon, southern part of the state. It was going to be sold, and there was thousands of varieties. There was a collection, the collection there. And they took it upon themselves to make sure that didn't happen, that the varieties were saved. And as part of that process, they purchased land out actually just a couple of miles from where I live, near Malala, and are in the process of planting thousands, propagating and planting thousands of apple trees on this place. And there'll be other fruits planted there as well. This has become such an interesting project that they're getting funding from international sources to help this happen, including apparently one of the people that's involved in the seed bank in Norway has become a sponsor of the project. So it's a very important project, and unfortunately, because we don't have the phones working, we can't talk to one of the people from it.
Hopefully next month we'll be able to get
Frankie
Macker, whoever.
Yeah, Joni Cooper, who is the president of the Home Orchard Society, is also president of this organization. And there's a website, www.temperateorchardconservancy, all three words put together, .org. And if listeners are interested, go there, check it out. They would love to have some help with funding. And so if you'd like to make a contribution to this worthy project, please do so. But it's a really very, very interesting thing to be doing here in the Northwest, and I strongly support it.
I'd also like to just mention that one of the founding members, but driving forces of the Home Orchard Society passed away in the last month since our last show, and Jerry Schroyer was a guest here on our show some years ago now.
Yes.
But just a good guy, but passed away unexpectedly at 83, I think.
85.
85.
And Jerry and I were going to have lunch the next day, and really sad. Good friend and a companion. I've known Jerry for 35 years, and he was fast the first banker that came to help me survive the economic storms of starting your own business. And Jerry was just a great guy, and we'll really, really miss him.
Yeah, just his knowledge. I talked a lot about apricots. I remember one time, does anybody grow an apricot? Do you know of anybody that's grown an apricot? No. I mean, you grow them, but do you get the fruit?
Yeah. And that's if any listeners out there know about apricot trees, I'd love to hear about it.
I've mentioned this before, but there's, according to an acquaintance, I haven't talked to her though for years, but there is one that's close to 100 years old on Northeast 18th. I've run by it. Big tree, maybe 2 to 3 feet in diameter of the. And she said she gets, I can't remember how often she'll get a fruit crop.
Well, we should pursue that a little bit. Maybe you can show me that someday.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. All righty. Well, what else is on our list here? Talking about, I want to go onto the farm bear, but let's just talk a little bit about dormant sprays.
Sure.
You don't do any dormant spraying, though, do you?
We do, but we not as much as we used to. We used to religiously put copper on every year.
And these are called so-called dormant sprays because they're applied when the tree is dormant, leafless.
Leafless, right.
Because these chemicals will... these applications will burn the leaves just chemically. And what we're talking about now are all considered organic, even though they're technically have never contained carbon, like copper,
right.
as Jim was just starting to say. But nevertheless, they are approved for use in organic farms and gardens.
Yeah, and copper, you can actually apply it. There's two different formulations,
yes.
And you can apply it with leaves too. But you have to. But your concentration is much less.
Right. So you need to get the right thing in the store.
Right. Well, actually, you just dilute it more.
Or you can do it that way, because there are some formulations that are
specifically designed.
Yeah.
We just dilute the one.
Okay.
Higher dilution, and our use of dormant sprays, as I say, has become much less. But we also use lime sulfur, which is a little less. It doesn't persist in the soil like copper does. Copper, if you use it for a long, long time, it can actually build up in the soil, and that's not so good for soil.
And lime sulfur is a fungicide.
Yes, we use it for basically the same preventing of disease, fungal diseases in the fall.
Another dormant spray that you might use is dormant oil, mm-hmm. and that is essentially smothers overwintering insect eggs. It's not a fungicide.
Yeah, it's a very useful spray.
Mm-hmm.
I think dormant oil, and you know, actually, I think I'm when I was talking about the copper, I was mistaken. I was thinking of dormant oil. Diluting the dormant oil so you can use it.
There is a summer oil.
Summer oil.
Yeah.
Sorry about that.
Okay.
But we do use that. That's our primary insecticide, is dormant oil. Is oil spray, whether it's dormant or non-dormant time in the season, and we use it on mites and aphids.
We'll call it summer oil, which he was talking about there for mites and other live insects. Mm-hmm. And then there's the dormant oil, which would be just to smother their eggs.
Yes.
Because the insects aren't out.
And scale.
Yes.
And this is where when we talk about growing citrus, which this time of year, you know, people might be thinking about citrus because they're the only plant show in town just about. Scale can be a problem on indoor citrus particularly, and a dormant oil, but the light, the more diluted form is a good preventive and treatment for scale,
mm-hmm.
on citrus.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
All right, so what else is happening on the farm?
Well, we have two visitors now from Vladivostok staying with us. Andrei and Luda just arrived, which is really fun because I get to speak Russian with them, and they tell me about things and what's going on in that part of the world, which is very, very cold. They get very cold, amazingly cold temperatures for a location that's actually south latitude-wise of where we are. So they can't do much there. So they come and hang out with us for the winter, and so that's really cool. We're doing cuttings right now, hardwood cuttings of honey berries and currants and gooseberries. This is a good time for propagating those. We put them right in our raised beds, garden soil
outside.
Huh? And they hang out all winter and start growing in the spring.
Could you put them in a fridge and then put them out later?
You could.
Okay.
Yep.
It's
definitely.
Just you got to put them someplace, so you might as well.
Yeah,
and well, you take your chances outside.
If you put them in the ground this time, if you can hold them for a while, but it's good to plant them because there's something about getting them out there in November and December.
You don't protect them though.
We don't protect them. No, they're hardwood cuttings and they're very hardy. So there's something. Yeah. And we drip them in a rooting hormone.
Okay.
And that works really well. We're pruning now. We've started doing pruning, of course. And one of the things we're pruning for is we're collecting cyanwood for the Home Orchard Society spring propagation fair in March. So just a little plug for that. Just thinking about folks that want to enjoy that, get some cyanwood, learn how to graft, do all sorts of stuff. That'll happen in a few months. So we're collecting, when we do our pruning, we collect wood for that purpose. That's fun. We also dug, we have a big project every November where we hire a tractor to come and dig our nursery stock. So all of the plants are now dug and in a greenhouse with dark shade on it, so it won't warm up. And we're grading them, so we grade them by size and prepare them for sale. The big plants.
Well, it's a cold month, so but it's a good thing you find something to do.
We don't have any problem, it seems like, you know. I know I spend a lot, I'm doing, working on indoor projects too, you know. We have a lot of, there's information to gather, to write stuff to people, to, you know, doing picture tags for plant advertising and this kind of thing, you know. So we have, and then with shipping, we start shipping plants and the garden centers, you know, even though it seems very early, you know, we have a pretty early spring here in Oregon. In February,
it's time to do that.
Starts to look like you can start planting. And
seems like a long time to go, but it isn't really.
It's not.
We've already hit, you know, it's about a close to 2 week period of the earliest. The sun is not going to set any later now. It's well before the solstice, but still.
And you know, it's amazing to, I mean, just the other day we were driving and we said just how far south the sun is setting this time of year.
Yeah, well, it's almost as far as it's going to go, but there'll be a little bit more. So we're setting, at least in Portland, it's the sunset is 4:27.
Yeah.
And it started on that about December 6th.
Really?
And it'll stay that way until almost 2 weeks.
Not even a minute difference?
No, that's it. Wow. I mean, but it's getting, the sunrise is later.
Yeah.
So the days are still getting shorter.
Yeah, I see.
But the sunset, it's the only sunset at the beginning of the day, not at the end of the day. Hmm. So, Farmer Jim, you're not going to lose any more daylight.
Yeah.
You reached it.
Yeah. Well, you know, when it's cold and you've got plenty of firewood, it's kind of a nice time to be sitting by the fire and
you
know, reading about things like like some plant stuff that we're going to find. And we're going to go to New Zealand in April and sort of planning for that journey. And feijoa, pineapple guava, that's one of the things we're going to go do some more exploring for.
Well, speaking of firewood, a friend gave me some very, very dry firewood, you know, 10 or more years old. Hmm. It's very nice. And as I was taking it out of the pickup, I discovered, I think it was alive. I'm pretty sure it was alive. I didn't want to test it too much. A hibernating butterfly or moth. I'm not sure which one it is, but on the underneath side, it was probably 1.5 inches in diameter, wings, mm-hmm. but it was orange.
That's interesting.
Yeah. So I think, you know, I saw some antenna moving, but I put it into my wood pile. It wasn't going to be, I don't know if it'll match. Survive that or not.
Some people may have experienced the somewhat distressing thing of bringing firewood into the house where there's a dormant bee.
Or most likely, a wasp.
Wasp, yeah. And all of a sudden you got this creature flying around in your house.
Well, not all of a sudden. It takes, you know, a half an hour or so for it to warm up.
Right, but an unwelcome guest.
Yeah, and my cats. So here we are, almost out of time, and time flies by even when we don't have the phones. But that's, I don't know when they expect to get that fixed, but just another mention for the KBOO listeners is that our phone system's not working.
Yeah, and we're really sorry we can't be interacting with you today.
Yeah. But well, maybe we'll go out on our last suggestion, which is an old Supertramp song, which is Hide in Your Shell. Mm-hmm. There's the shell. So we had the, you know, pick up the pieces, everyone's a piece of me, and then we got the shell there. So
okay, good job.
Jim Gilbert, thank you.
Thanks, Glenn.
Glad you could make it in, even hauling yourself off the deathbed. And this is Glenn Andreessen. We'll be back next month, both of us.
Yep.
We'll be here. So, thanks for listening. Thanks, Tammy. That's our story. Here's Supertramp.
KBOO Community Radio and Chamber Music Northwest have been working together for over 40 years to bring diverse music to the community and to underserved populations, and we are working together in the Give Guide. There are opportunities for tickets to Christian Tetzloff's performance of Bach's solo violin works and other thank you gifts. More information is available at kboo.fm/cmnw2017.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Help Drive with Big Water on Saturday, December 16th at 8 p.m. at the Portway Tavern in Portland. Local singer-songwriter Big Water will perform Americana roots rock and gather food, socks,